like if you look at all the on the options chains, there's a ton of short calls at these prices, so it's getting hard to break them because there's been the options.
I've heard nothing, no news. So.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
What's that?
23. It's a new low. 24.2. But you're looking at a more longer time frame, right?
You got it. Yeah, don't watch the price. My suggestion is stop looking at the price.
I'm a short-term trader.
Well, then you don't care about that.
I don't care about value. Yeah, I don't care if it's worth. I don't know. I don't care what it's worth. I just
then you got to worry about mood and momentum.
Yeah, I know. Right now the mood is so pessimistic.
Those things can shift on a dot.
I know.
You never know when it'll happen. But
I'm waiting for like some headlines.
The question is, what will go about first, your stomach or the?
My stomach is iron.
Okay.
So, but I'm waiting for a big short squeeze.
Okay, so if you got the email about the final exams, the Google spreadsheet is up, so it's only if you're taking the early final that you got to go in and sign it. If you're regular final, you're fine. But just to keep you updated, the project is due a week from today, 5 p.m. a week from today. And I will send an email out about the relative valuation because I know some of you are struggling with, hey, what if it doesn't look good? What if I don't trust the number? You don't trust the number, you don't use it, right? Ultimately, you get to decide which valuation you're going to base your recommendation on. So if after all you're working with a multiple and comparables, you say, I don't trust this PE ratio, or don't trust this EV to EBITDA, let it go. Don't sit there fighting the data saying, I want the R squared to be high, I want this to make sense. If it doesn't make sense, it doesn't make sense. And you say, look, that's not the way I'm going to make my recommendations. I'm not going to go with the relative valuation. So stop fighting with the data. It is what it is. So work with what you have and make your best judgment and move on. So today we're going to talk about acquisition. So before I get started, anybody here who's committed to an M&A job? Okay. Keep your hands up because I might call on you. Okay. Don't worry, I won't hold you to the if you fail more than two tests, then you got to quit your job kind of thing. You need the money anyway, you know. So, and given the state of M&A banking, you can't really bring it down. It's as low as it can get, right? So you can only bring it up. So think of yourself as this noble influence that's going to change the future of M&A. So let's start with the bad news today. The bad news is that acquisitions don't work for acquiring companies. They work great for target companies. If you're a target company, this is the best news of the... So when you look at the price movements of acquiring and target companies, it is no contest. So this is a study. This is from studies that look at what happens to acquiring company share prices and what happens to target company share prices. So there's your target company, the red line. The blue line is the acquiring company. So you can see acquiring companies essentially have a drift and it tends to be a negative drift. You're saying it's so small. But remember, acquiring companies tend to be much bigger than target companies. So a 2% drop in the acquiring company and a 25% drop in the target company might in fact be equivalent numbers. So if you look at this graph, acquiring company stockholders clearly don't gain from acquisitions. Part of today's session is about why, what's going on here. If you look at target company shareholders, it's good news, right? See this day zero? That is actually the day of the announcement, the day supposedly that the world learns that there's going to be an acquisition. And then that day, the stock price jumps. But notice what seems to be happening in the days leading up to the acquisition. Now, you could take a very big picture view and say, this shows you how efficient markets are. They can anticipate things even before they're announced. Or you can take the cynical view and say that something is leaking and somebody's making money. I'll take the cynical view here, that no matter how much you write laws to prevent this from happening, news leaks out from lots of different places, and there's trading ahead of acquisitions. In fact, one of the things the SEC does to look for insider trading is they work backwards. They look at who's put big trades in the weeks before, and so if you're going to do this, do it. I shouldn't be suggesting this, but you know what you need to do. Don't be stupid. Don't get greedy, and it happens all the time. So on the acquisition day, the acquiring company shareholders lose, and the target company shareholders win. Now, if you present this evidence to M&A bankers, their first reaction is, but it's one day, or it's the weeks around the announcement. The shareholders don't get to see what we see. And let's face it, U.S. bankers and as managers in the merger get to see numbers the shareholders never do, right? The inside numbers, so you do have more information. And their response is just wait. Wait a few years, and then you're going to see the good stuff happen. So let's see if, in fact, the evidence backs them up. If you look at what happens after acquisitions, the news is even more depressing than what happens on the acquisition day. KPMG did a study of almost 8,000 mergers in the late 1990s. And it asked a very simple question. You know that magic word synergy that gets used in so many acquisitions? The question it asked was, in what percentage of mergers does synergy actually show up? The answer was 16%. In 1 in 6 mergers, so if you define synergy as the combined company doing better than the individual companies, in 1 of 6 mergers, synergy shows up. In the remaining 5, not only does it not show up, but in a substantial number of cases, there's negative synergy. What does that mean? The two companies come together and somehow the combined company is worse than either company was as individual companies. McKinsey has been doing these studies every decade for the last, I think, 40 years, where they ask two very simple questions about acquisitions. Did the return on capital on the acquisition exceed the cost of capital? Fundamental question we ask in any capital budgeting exercise, right? And then it asks a follow-up question. Did this acquisition help the parent company outperform the peer group? In other words, very simple test. And in a significant percentage of mergers, companies fail both tests. So not only is the news bad at the time of the acquisition date, if you follow through, there doesn't seem to be much good news either. Now, we've known this because study after study for the last 30 years has kind of brought this out. In fact, it's one of the most consistent findings in M&A studies is acquiring company shareholders seem to lose on acquisitions. And the scary thing is this disease, instead of getting cured over time, that people learn over time is actually not just getting worse, it's spreading. Let me explain. For a long time, when you looked at emerging market companies, they were usually the beneficiaries of acquisitions because they were often the target companies in acquisitions. So 30 years ago, an Indian company would never buy a U.S. company, just didn't have the capital, wouldn't have been able to pull it off. In the last 10, 15 years, of course, Indian companies, Chinese companies, Brazilian companies have now become the acquirers. He said, maybe they've learned their lesson. Maybe it's a U.S. problem. Maybe acquirers in other countries don't do the same thing. And you're starting to see the first wave of studies of acquirers in emerging markets. And guess what? They seem to do the same thing that U.S. acquirers do, which is if you look at what happens to the stock prices of acquiring companies, this is from a study of Indian acquiring companies, initially the response is actually positive to the acquisition. The news stories are always glowing, you know, Tetley, you know, Tata Tea buys Tetley Tea, or Tata Steel buys Cora Steel. The response is almost nationalistic. Oh, finally, our companies are the acquirers, not the targets. That's where the good news ends. Because as you track these acquisitions over time, you see the market increasingly becoming more and more negative once the numbers come out. Now, anytime I present this evidence, of course, people point to the companies that have succeeded with acquisitions. Last year, actually, I did this presentation, and a portfolio manager front group said, "You're wrong. Think of Valiant." And I said, "Really? Okay. Let's wait and see." Because every time, and I hate to be cynical again, I actually love being cynical, I have to say that, though I hate being cynical, okay, is every time somebody presents a company as the center of as a company that's grown through acquisition successfully, my response is just wait. Because history suggests that if you wait long enough, almost every one of these companies blows up, either from hubris, because they get so successful they think they can pull it off. Cisco from the 1990s going into the next decade, or because acquisitions allow you to play games with your accounting that you could never get away with traditional investing. In fact, that's my biggest worry. I mean, I brought the Pfizer mug with me today, because I started doing my taxes for 2016, and I said, I'd like to invert myself too, create an Irish dummy of me. Now, I don't know how that would work. Okay? But when Pfizer buys Allergan, Allergan is a company that's grown through acquisitions. And if nothing else, as a Pfizer stockholder, that scares me. So the question then becomes, why do we keep seeing this? If the definition of insanity is you keep doing the same thing over and over again, M&A banking, M&A as a process is insane. Because we know that the mistakes happen, but we keep repeating those mistakes. And what I think, the only thing I can explain, it's not that M&A bankers are stupid. Some of the brightest people working in M&A, it's that the process is screwed up. There's something in the process that is causing bad deals to happen. So what I'd like to do is take you inside the process and think about what are the things that cause bad deals to happen. And perhaps along the way, we can start developing a way in which you can be a disciplined acquirer. Maybe that's an oxymoron, a way of... So we look at the places in M&A where value can still be created. And perhaps by staying focused on those places, we might be able to devise a way in which to create value from acquisitions. So here are the seven things we're going to talk about today, the seven-step test that I'm going to take you through. The first is what I'm going to call risk transference. And what I mean by that is acquiring companies that think that they can take their risk characteristics and transmit it to target companies. I'm a safe company, therefore if I buy a risky company, the risky company is going to get safe. We're going to start with that. The second is what I'm going to call the debt subsidy. The debt subsidy reflects the fact that if you're an acquiring company with access to debt and you can borrow money at a really low rate because you have a great rating, you take that debt and you feed it into the target company and you, in a sense, subsidize the target company. We're going to see the mechanics by which it happens, but it happens all the time. The third is something we've talked about off and on, which is this notion of control and paying a premium for control. As I've mentioned earlier, M&A deals, you value the target company and you add 20%, 25% for control. We're going to start digging at what exactly that means. On Wednesday, we're actually going to come up with a way of valuing control that goes beyond the hand-waving. The fourth is we're going to deal with synergy front and center. You say, okay, if there's synergy, let's value it. We're going to talk about the processes for valuing synergy depending on the type of synergy you're talking about. The fifth is we're going to talk about pricing in the context of acquisitions. Remember, the two ways of doing valuation is one is to do an intrinsic valuation, the other is a relative valuation. M&A deals are often driven by pricing, and we'll talk about why that happens, and then we'll talk about the right way to do pricing in acquisitions and the wrong way. And unfortunately, the wrong way wins out more often than the right way. The sixth is a problem that I think is almost behavioral. In most acquisitions, guess where the idea for the deal originates? Not with the janitor, not with a low person in the totem pole, but with somebody very high up. The CEO goes to sleep one night, dreams about an acquisition, and the next day the process gets started. He's saying, so what? In most acquisitions, I'm convinced that the decision gets made first, the acquisition follows. There is so much bias in this process that it's almost impossible, no matter how well-intentioned you are, to be objective once the deal process gets started. And finally, I am amazed at how little accountability there is in acquisitions, at how few CEOs lose their jobs after $5 billion mistakes, and how much people are willing to forgive big mistakes in acquisitions and let them go. So let's start with these. And before I do it, I'm going to set up a page that I'd like you to fill out honestly when you get a chance. And this is for your own purposes. So you don't have to show me what test. So with each one, you decide whether you pass. So I'm going to put a series of tests to you, and you can decide whether you pass the test or fail the test. If you fail the test, I'm going to allow you to come up with whatever rationalization you want for why it was okay that you failed the test. But this is more about knowing yourself than about convincing me that you're going to do the right thing. So let's start the game. Let's assume that you are the acquiring company. You can either play the role of the banker or you can play the role of the manager of the acquiring company. Those are the only two players. The shareholders are not players in the game, right? So only if you think about an M&A deal, there are four people in the room. Let's say make it a friendly merger. Here are the four people. There's the CEO, management of the acquiring firm, and the management of the target firm. They're the bankers for both. Four people in the room, right? CEO of the acquiring firm, CEO of the target firm, investment banker for the acquiring firm, investment banker for the target firm. They're the only four people in the room. Who in that room does not want the deal to go through? It's a friendly merger. So the CEO of the acquiring company obviously wants it to go through because he's made up his mind already. The CEO for the target firms, this is wonderful. And the bankers, of course, are holding it. Please, please, let the deal go through no matter how bad. What I'm saying is you created a room where nobody is going to play devil's advocate. Nobody wants to be the one bringing up unpleasant questions. So when I talk about process, that's the process we're talking about. And maybe we have to start thinking about how do we make that process a process where the people who are spending their money, which is the shareholders of the acquiring company, have a say in that process. So let's assume that this, your acquiring company, I'm going to present you with the target company. Let's keep things really simple so you're not kind of caught up in the distractions of the details of valuation. So here's what the target company looks like. It has revenues of $100 million, operating expenses of $80 million, operating income of $20 million, taxes of $8 million, after-tax operating income of $12 million. This is a stable growth company. You can assume that it will generate this after-tax operating income every year in perpetuity with no growth. So I'm trying to make the math as simple as possible. And it's a risky company. So let's assume that the cost of equity is 20%, but because the firm uses no debt, the cost of capital is also 20%. So you ready? You have the after-tax operating income. The company expects to sustain that operating income forever. The cost of equity and cost of capital are both 20%. What is the intrinsic value of this target company? Let's go step by step. I've given you the after-tax operating income. You need cash flow, right? To get to cash flow, what do you need? You need to subtract out reinvestment, add depreciation. In this case, though, what have I told you about growth? The growth is zero, so your reinvestment is zero. So your after-tax operating income is your cash flow. So $12 million is your cash flow. You're going to get it every year forever. Your cost of capital is 20%. What's the value of the company? 12 divided by, not 20, but 12, 12 divided by 20%, which gives you $60 million. So you ready? So that's your base number. Write that somewhere and then forget it, because in a sense, you want to do the acquisition. The $60 million is your base number. So here's my first try. Let's assume that as the acquiring company, you're in a safe business and your cost of equity is only 10%. Remember the target company showed in the last page? What's the value of the target company now? You see the question I'm asking you. Is it still 60 or has it become 120? I've heard three answers. I heard 60, I heard 120, and I heard somebody say somewhere in the middle. Nice way to fudge the answer, but unfortunately, only one of these numbers is right. Go back to corporate finance. In capital budgeting, what's the rule on discount rates? The discount rate for a project should reflect what? The risk of the project, not the risk of the company looking at the project, right? Think of this acquisition as a project. It's a risky company. It has a 20% discount rate based on its risk. It doesn't matter that you're a safe company with a lower cost of equity. The value of the target company hasn't changed 1 cent just because you're a safe company. Now comes the bad news. Half of all acquisition valuations that I see mess up this very fundamental principle. Mess up in what sense? I see the acquiring company's discount rate used to value the target company on this very misguided notion of we raise the capital, that's what it costs us to raise capital, therefore we should be using that discount rate. The cost of capital is not the cost of raising funding for an investment, it's the discount rate that's appropriate given the risk of that investment. Now let's assume that you do the wrong thing, that you take the acquiring company's cost of equity and you start valuing target companies and you're a safe acquiring company. Let's carry this through to its logical limit. When you look across the landscape of companies, what kinds of companies are going to look cheap to you? Any risky company is going to look cheap to you. Why? Because you're attaching a lower cost of equity. So if you go crazy, you'll be buying risky company after risky company after risky company saying, I got a bargain. What an incredible... And at the end of the process, what are you going to have? AT&T at the end of the 1990s. Because this is exactly how Lucent and AT&T played this game through the 90s. Is they kept buying risky companies, attaching their cost of equity to it, thinking they were walking away with a great deal, when in fact, they were loading up their company with immensely risky businesses that they're overpaid for. So first rule in acquisitions is do not use the acquiring company's beta or cost of equity for anything to do with the target company. Now the question of why can't I use an average? If you're valuing the combined company, you can use the average. But if you're valuing the target company is what it is. And you can't make it safer by attaching your risk to it. Yes? Now comes, I was hoping that somebody would bring that up. There, why is the cost of equity for the private company high? Use the framework we used when we did private company valuation. What makes the cost of equity high? We used a total beta to reflect the fact they were not diversified. In other words, their market cost of equity might have been only 10%, but because the owner was not diversified, he or she is using 20%. Then, is it appropriate to use the 10%? Then it's okay, because in a sense, you're a public company, so that's going to be one of those few places in acquisitions where you can create value. If a public company goes around rolling up private businesses, the private business owner might think he's getting a bargain if you use a 15% cost of equity. But you're getting a bargain because you've settled for 10%. That's going to be one of those spaces where you're willing to pay a premium. But it's not because you're using your cost of equity. Be very clear about what the cost of equity you're using is. You're using the market cost of equity for the target company, which might be 10%, it might be 8%, it might be 6%, it might be 12%. So don't use it as a license for using your cost of equity. You still want to come up with the market cost of equity for that private company. Now let's take the second step. So let's assume that you've done the right thing. You've gone back to the 20% cost of equity saying, hey, that's the risk of the company. However, you as the acquiring company have access to lots of debt. You have excess debt capacity and you have a very good rating. So you're able to borrow money after taxes at 4%. So let's think purely in mechanical terms. Half the money for this acquisition is going to come from debt at a 4% rate. The other half is going to come from equity. And let's leave the cost of equity at 20%. I know you've got unlevered and re-levered betas. Let's say you leave it at 20%. If you just plug and chug, what's your cost of capital going to be? 0.5 times 20% plus 0.5 times 4%, which it'll give you. 12%. If you take that 12% and you use it to value the target company, remember the $12 million cash flow. With a 12% cost of capital, your value for the target company will become $100 million, right? This is magic. You've just increased the value of the target company by $40 million. If you now go out and pay $100 million for the target company, Are you getting a fair deal? Looks like it, right? Look at the numbers. Present. But why are you paying the extra $40 million? Where is that extra $40 million in value coming from? It's coming from the fact that you have a really good rating and you have excess debt capacity. Here's my simple rule in acquisition. Render unto the target company shareholders that which is theirs and not a penny more. This has nothing to do with the target company. If you pay this as a premium, do you see why you're paying the premium? It has nothing to do with the target company. It's because you've earned debt capacity over the last 50 years. You have a really good rating and now you're using it to pay a premium. So the second rule in acquisition valuation is when you do the cost of capital for an acquisition, first, do not use the debt ratio that you're using to fund the acquisition, because I could effectively use 100% debt. If I have a lot of debt capacity, I can borrow all of the money to do an acquisition. Do not use the debt ratio that you use for the actual acquisition, because it might come from something else, something outside the target company, and do not use your cost of debt. It's still your. Here's the thing to think about: if you can borrow money in a region where you get a high tax rate, you get a tax benefit, right? You're going to get that tax benefit whether you do the acquisition or not. Why do you have to do the acquisition? So if you want the tax benefit, borrow the money, get the tax benefit. Stop. Do you see where I'm going next? If you do a bad acquisition on top of a good transaction, you just make the good transaction less good. So don't let a good reason drive a bad deal. So when you think about acquisitions, do not give the target company the benefits of the fact that you have a low cost of debt and excess debt capacity. I'll tell you the one caveat, though. I told you that the target company used no debt. Let's assume the target company could have borrowed money as a standalone company. It's underlevered. It could have been at a 20% debt ratio and could have borrowed money at 6%. Then it is possible when you do the acquisition valuation that you could use the 20-80 mix and the 6% cost of debt. And what are you doing there? You're effectively saying the target company is not run optimally. I'm going to fix it. That's going to be one of the pieces in the value of control. Is we have an under-levered company, you might decide to use that leverage, but it is not your leverage you're using. It's the target company's own debt capacity. So what I'm arguing is when you value the target company, you want to separate. You want to separate the target company and treat it as a standalone company and not subsidize it because of stuff you're bringing into the process. Any questions on the cost of debt? Now let's talk about control premiums. As I said, in most acquisitions, that 20% comes out of left field, out of 20%. And if you push people, they're not quite clear what they're paying the premium for. It's control. So what's control? Control. You keep going around in circles. What exactly does that mean? And if you ask them, where does that 20% come from? It actually is very simple. The way the 20% premium has been backed up by bankers is by looking at a database called MergerStat. It's actually a database of all acquisitions done in the U.S. going back about 50 years. You can subscribe to it. I think we have access to the data through the school. And the 20% is actually, roughly speaking, the average premium paid above the market price by acquiring companies and doing acquisitions. So their rationale is, in acquisitions, people pay a 20% premium. And because they pay a 20% premium, we're going to use it as a control premium. What's the flaw in that logic? First, why do acquiring companies pay premiums? What are the things that go into the premium? There's control, maybe. There is synergy, and there is stupidity, right? I mean, because if you overpay, where does it go? It goes in the premium. So there's control, synergy, and stupidity. So 20% is the collective premium you're paying for all three. If you add that on top of the value, first, you built in potentially a synergy value already into the control premium. You better not be adding a synergy premium on next to it. That'll be double counting. And you're building in the overpayment into what you're paying. So let's step back and let's think about what the value of control is. The value control, and I've said this before, both in corporate finance and valuation, is you think you can run a company better than the existing people running the company. So if you take this target company that I just showed you, if you remember, I had a $20 million pre-tax operating income on $100 million revenue. right? That was the target company. Let's say you look at the company, say, if I ran that company, I could cut costs. I'd be more efficient. I'd earn a 30% margin. Let's assume everything else about the target company stays the same. What would the value of the target company be? Instead of 20 million, you'd make 30 million pre-tax. Instead of 12 million, it'd be 18 million after tax. You divide 18 million by 0.2, which is the cost of equity and capital, you end up with 90 million. You're willing to pay a $30 million premium. Why? Because you think the target company is badly managed and badly run. If I add on top of that, the target company could borrow money. It could be a 20% debt, 80% equity. That comes into play as well. Maybe your cost of capital would not be 20%, it would be 18%, which makes your value $100 million. So I'm not saying there is no value for control, but the value of control comes from looking at the target company and saying, what would I run? What did I do in this company that would make it a more valuable company? Which then leads to a very interesting implication. If the target company I'm looking at is already perfectly managed and perfectly run, what control premium should I be paying for it? Zero. So you cannot really have a 20% control premium across all cases without looking at the target company asking, what can I fix in the company? So be careful about these rules of thumb. Add 20% for that, subtract 15% for that. Usually there'll be no subtracting in M&A banking. It's all adding because you've got to get to that high number. So there'll be premium on top of premium. Just walk away from it. Because even if it comes from historical data, there are lots of things that are already embedded in your valuation. You're probably double counting by adding these premiums. Because you'll see brand name premium. In a sense, be willing for a premium extravaganza, because people are going to keep adding things. Well, how about this? How about that? Because effectively what they're trying to do is push up that number to justify the price you have to pay. Which brings me to synergy. Okay. Of course, this is the magical word that drives so many acquisitions. And of course, there is this perception that, at least in finance, we are dyspeptic about synergy. We really don't attach value to synergy. That's not true. In fact, to set up the synergy discussion, let's look at a few potential scenarios. You can see where synergy makes sense and where it doesn't. Let's assume that I tell you that by combining these two companies, remember that your acquiring company and mine, that the combined company is going to be much safer than the two companies standing alone. And therefore, because it's safer, it should have a lower cost of capital. Sounds pretty intuitive, right? Two companies, risky companies, come together, you create a safer company. Because you have a safer company, you should have a lower cost of capital. Take me through that reasoning and tell me which step I'm screwing up on. Because if this were the case, you should have acquisitions like crazy. Because you should have conglomerate mergers, you should have companies coming together from different businesses. What part of that logic is wrong? First, let's start with the first step in the logic, where I said combining two companies in different businesses is going to create a safer business. Is that true? Yeah, because you got the covariance term. Remember, so that part is right. So you are a safer company. Safer companies will have lower costs of capital. Is that true? Maybe I should put that on the final. This is, what goes into a cost of capital? A cost of equity and a cost of debt. If it's a publicly traded company, we'll talk about private business, how do I get a cost of equity? Come on. I take a risk-free rate, I come up with a beta, and I multiply by an equity risk premium, right? What is a beta measure? Risk you cannot diversify away. It's not total risk, it's market risk. Do you see where I'm going to go next? If you've already in your cost of equity factored in only the risk you cannot eliminate by combining across companies, a merger can't make you have a lower cost of capital. The beta you will have will just be a weighted average of your two betas. There can be no benefit in terms of risk. And intuitively, here's what I'm saying. As a shareholder, I could have bought shares in both companies before you did the merger, right? There's no magic here. You can't combine the two companies. Hey, I have a safer company for you because I already had you in my portfolios. So if you're looking at two public companies, this can never be the reason for a merger. I've taken a big reason that people throw at mergers out of the equation. Don't tell me that you're doing mergers to make yourself a safer company. Maybe you can get a side benefit. Maybe you can borrow more money as a safer company. If that's the case, make your argument about debt capacity. It cannot be that by combining two companies, you're just safer. Now, could it be different if I have two private businesses coming together? Absolutely. And where would it show up in terms of mechanics? Let's say company A, the owner had a correlation of 25% of the market. Company B had an owner had a correlation with 25% of the market. I combined the two companies. What's the correlation going to look like now? It's going to be a little higher than 25%. In fact, think about this. If I, as a private business, kept diversifying more and more and ultimately became almost like a mutual fund, I own 50 different businesses, what's the correlation of the owner's portfolio with the market going to look like? It's going to approach one. My market beta and my total beta are going to converge. So if you're a private business embarking on a conglomerate merger spree, I understand it. Public companies, though, that reasoning doesn't make sense. But let's look at potential synergies that do make sense. Let's say I told you that by combining these two companies, I have potential for higher growth in the combined company or lower costs. Economies of scale or growth opportunities. Then is there a value to merge to synergy? Absolutely. And to value the synergy, here's what I'd have to do. I'll have to value the acquiring company separately, the target company separately, then I have to value the combined company with the synergy benefits thrown in. And that's where you separate control from synergy. Control you can accomplish with just the target firm. You don't even need the acquiring firm. Synergy requires both firms to come together. So when somebody says there's synergy in a merger, push them on it. Because 9 times out of 10, they're not talking about synergy, they're talking about control. Separate the two because they're two different components of the premium. So synergy really comes from valuing the combined company with what you see as the benefits. So let me lay out the big picture for valuing synergy. When I think about synergy, synergy can come from one of two places. It can be operating synergy or financial synergy. Let's start with operating synergy. The most obvious and simplest operating synergy to value is economies of scale. What kinds of mergers were you most likely to see this kind of synergy? Same companies in the same business, two steel companies coming together, two airlines coming together, but it never seems to create synergy. It just seems to create costs. No, but basically, two companies in the same business coming together saying, by combining the two companies, we're going to create cost savings. AB InBev and SAB Miller, that is supposedly one of the reasons. The only thing puzzling is they have almost no geographic overlap, which is normally something you think of with economies of scale. But, you know, if you have two companies in the same business, the reason it's a simple synergy to value is if that's your motivation for the merger, and I have the margin for the two companies before the merger, what should happen to the margin after the merger? It should go up. The cost will shrink. The margin should go up. It's the easiest of all synergies to value because all you have to do is show the higher margin after and say, I'm done. Let's look at the more ambitious synergies. And these are the synergies that get strategists' juices flowing, which is growth synergies, which is by combining the two companies, we're going to be able to make higher returns on new investments. Why? Because we have more pricing power, we have more strength. It could be that you can find more new investments to take as a combined company. They're going to be able to do things you could not have done as standalone companies. Or maybe your competitive advantages got stronger as a combined company, and because you have stronger competitive advantages, you're able to earn more than the cost of capital for a longer period. Do you see what I'm trying to do? Whatever the synergy is, I'm looking for a number in my valuation that I can show. If you talk about higher returns on capital, I show you a higher return on capital, which translates to a higher growth and a higher value. If you talk about more investments, you're talking about a higher reinvestment rate, which pushes up the growth rate and pushes up value. If you're talking about stronger competitive advantages, you're talking about a longer growth period, 10 years instead of 5 years, which pushes up value. Now, what are those stronger competitive advantages? There are two motives for mergers that I call Voldemort motives. You remember Voldemort from Harry Potter? Because through all 7 books, he was brought up, his name could not be mentioned. These are two motives that if you have them, don't talk about them. One is monopoly power. Time Warner, Comcast. The subtext of that merger is, after we do this, we will control 75% of all broadband internet access in the country. and you can fill in the rest of the story. You know why you don't want to bring this up, right? Because when the antitrust people look at mergers, this is one of the first things they look at. Will it create? And the reason is, if you create monopoly power, you're going to have essentially higher excess returns because you get pricing power and you get higher value. The second reason you should never mention is taxes. If that is the prime reason for your merger, shut up. Do not talk about it. That's what drove me crazy about this Pfizer-Allergan deal. Even if inversion was the main reason, don't bring it up. Everybody might know it's there. It's like the elephant in the room. But act like you don't see it. What? No, it's all driven by growth and talk economies of scale. Talk about growth. No. You know why, right? Because the minute a deal is primarily tax motivated, you know what's coming. The tax guys will push back. That's their job. It's not because they're bad people. If you are tax motivated, that's the primary reason, they're going to push back. And let's face it, a lot of acquisitions, that's a hidden subtext. And let's see some of the forms that tax benefits can take in a merger. One is right after a merger happens, the accountants get called in. And what's their job? Purchase price allocation. One of the most useless exercises in valuation from a pure valuation perspective, because the mistake's already been made. This is like moving the chairs on the Titanic after you hit the iceberg, saying, oh, let's make it look really good while we go down. That's what purchase price allocation is. After the acquisition is done, the accountant comes in and reappraises the values of all your assets. There is one potential benefit that is a real benefit, which is if they reappraise assets which have depreciation at a higher number, you could get higher depreciation going forward, and that's a real tax benefit. Unfortunately, though, the IRS knows that if I left you to your own devices, what are you going to do? You're going to push up everything up to the purchase price and depreciate for the rest of eternity. So there are rules. This is accounting. It's all about rules. And you can push to the limits, but when you're done, you're still going to have a big chunk of that acquisition price that's unaccounted for. Where does that go? Goodwill. Which then I have to keep calling you back every year for the next 50 years. And this is great. It's make work for accountants there. So what do I ask you to come back and do every year for the next 50 years? Reappraise the goodwill and tell me whether it's been impaired. Another exercise in futurity. Because by the time accountants come to the conclusion that goodwill has been impaired, the market's already passed on, because that was 2 years ago that everybody knew that you'd screwed up on this deal. So if you look at acquisitions, if you can push up your depreciation, obviously it helps you. Can a money-making company take over a money-losing business and create tax benefits? Looks like it, right? You have 100 million profits, you buy a company with 100 million in losses, you end up with zero taxable income, therefore you have no taxes. True. But here's the rule on taxes. If it's that simple, the tax guy is also going to think about it, and he's going to push back by putting rules on whether you can do this. And in the US, it's very, very difficult for money-making companies to buy money-losing companies and to claim the tax benefit. You've got to meet all these requirements. But if you can pull that off, you get some tax benefits. And the net operating losses of the tax of the money-losing company can now reduce your taxes going forward. And we'll come back and talk about the specifics of how exactly to value that NOL. But there are some countries where actually the tax code is written in a way that encourages acquisitions. I'll give you a couple of examples. In Brazil, there's an item that you're allowed to claim as a tax deduction called interest on capital. You know what it is? I allow you to take your book value of equity and multiply it by a rate that's given by the Brazilian government every year and claim it like a tax deduction. You say, why would they do that? It was their ham-handed attempt to kind of offset the tax benefit of debt. Remember, you get the interest expenses as a tax benefit. They say, we're gonna try to make this a more even game. So this year, for instance, 11%. You take your book equity, multiply by 11%, and that's a tax reduction. You say, what's this got to do with acquisitions? When you do an acquisition, almost magically, the day after the acquisition, what happens to your book equity? It's going to go up. Simply because you bought that, got that goodwill item on the other side of the balance sheet, your book equity is going to go up. See what's going to happen next? If your book equity goes up, what happens to your tax deduction next year? 11% of a much bigger book equity reduces your taxes, and that can create substantial value. When InBev was acquired by the Belgian, InBev, InBev, it's all become one company now. The original acquisition of InBev, which was then a Brazilian company, which used to be called Brahma, in that original acquisition, a premium of $2 billion was paid. It was estimated that 1.1 out of the 2 billion came from this tax benefit of interest and capital, which means Brazilian taxpayers were effectively subsidizing the synergy in the deal to 55% of the synergy. That's the first example. The second is an example that drives the EU crazy. Spain, among all of the EU countries, is the only country that allows you to claim, and I don't know whether this is still true, but until a couple of years it was, that allows you to claim the impairment of goodwill or the amortization of goodwill as a tax deduction. No other part of the world, most of the world, the goodwill is a useless item. You can impair it, you can amortize it, nobody cares because it doesn't affect your taxes. But in Spain, you get a tax benefit. Do you see how this is going to help you? Let's say you buy a company with a $1 billion market cap for $10 billion. You have $9 billion in goodwill. I allow you to write that goodwill off over time and claim a tax reduction. It's like a gift on a platter, right? And this is what drives the rest of the EU crazy. So if a Spanish company and a German company are competing for an Italian company, what have I just created? I've essentially created a process where the Spanish company can pay more than the German company because I've created a tax code that allows it. You say, why do the Germans care? It's a Spanish taxpayer who's paying. What makes the Germans really crazy? It's a German taxpayer who pays for the Spanish company to be paid, because the nature of taxes in Europe has essentially gotten so muddled that you can have individual countries have strange tax rules and the entire EU bears the cost. So it's the tax benefits. I talked about added debt capacity, about how combining two companies can make them safer. That's true. And if you become safer, it's possible that you could borrow more money than you used to. So you have two companies that used to have a 20% debt ratio, and that was the right debt ratio for them. You create a combined company because it's safer. You might be able to borrow 30%. That shows up as a higher debt ratio in your cost of capital and a higher value. And if you have private businesses, as I said, combining two private businesses can create a diversification benefit. So let's talk about the specifics of value synergy. To me, value synergy is a three-step process. The first step in the process, I value the two companies involved in the merger independently as standalone companies. Forget about the merger. Act as if they're standalone companies. Value them. Step two, just add the two numbers up. One of the great things about present values, they're additive. So if I have the value of the first company at 100 and the value of the second company at 50, the value of the combined company, if there were no synergy, is going to be 100 plus 50, 150. You're done. Step three. Take the combined company, and you can go to town on this combined company. You can take every conceivable synergy you can think of and throw it into the combined company. Higher growth, lower cost. And assuming the synergies have some heft to them, the combined company's value is going to be much greater than the values of the two independent companies. That difference is the value of synergy. So let's try this with a company. This was a few years ago, almost more than a decade ago, that Procter & Gamble, at that point in time, the largest consumer product company in the world, bought Gillette, which is the sixth largest consumer product company in the world. Huge merger. Bankers, you know, this is a banker's dream. Two big companies coming together. And the reason I picked this company is there was talk of synergy all through this process of how this deal was going to have immense synergy. So here's what I did. I first valued Procter & Gamble as a standalone company and Gillette as a standalone company. I came up with a value of $221.3 billion for Procter & Gamble and about $59.9 million for Gillette. Let me pause right there. I have two companies. One is worth $222 billion. The other is worth $60 billion. If I combine the two companies, and I've called the combined company Piglet, Procter & Gamble, Gillette, but they preferred to call themselves Procter & P&G after that still. If there were no synergy, the value of the combined company would just be the sum of the two. So you're done, right? And here's what I did as the final step. I looked through the news stories, the merger. I took everything that the managers of the two companies claimed they would do after the merger, and I assumed they would do it right away. This is a best case valuation of synergy. You're taking them at their word, and you're assuming it happens instantaneously. So they talked about cutting operating expenses by $250 million, primarily in advertising, because they said, we're two big companies that advertise a lot. By combining, we can reduce our advertising budget. So, okay, I'm going to assume it happens tomorrow. So basically, I cut the expense by $250 million, and that pretty much pushes into the operating income right there, right? I cut the expenses, my operating income goes up by $250 million. They said they would have a higher growth rate as a global company. I said, okay, I'll assume you have a higher growth rate, and I'll assume it happens instantaneously. So the 11.58% compounded growth becomes 12.5%. And I value the synergy with those changes put in. The value that I got for the combined company with those changes put in was $298.4 billion, which was about $17.2 billion higher than what I got for the combined companies, as standalone companies. At least based on my estimates, the best case value for synergy is $17.2 billion. That's a lot of money, right? But here's a scary number, $25 billion. You know what that is? That is the actual premium that Procter & Gamble paid for Gillette. And then we wonder why acquisitions don't create value for acquiring company shareholders. You take the best case valuation of $17.2 billion, you pay a premium on top of that. How the heck are your shareholders going to get any share of the spoils? In fact, the reality is that $17.2 billion would probably be lower rather than higher, right? Why? Because when managers talk about cutting costs by $250 million, you're lucky if they get to $250. They stop at $220, $180, $160. And second, have any of you worked at a big company which has been involved in a merger with another big company at the time of the merger? No? Imagine working in Citigroup. You did? Who do you work for? Okay. Tell me the day after the merger when you came in, did you notice anything different? No, it looked the same company. Say you have two, I'm sorry? The technology got screwed up. So you're telling me the bad news, which is nothing worked anymore. But you have two HR departments. It's almost like two companies wandering off in parallel paths. To show you how long this dysfunction can last, I used to do training programs for Citibank at that time, Travelers, and Salomon in the early 1990s. As three separate companies. And of course, you know the history, which is, you know, Salomon got acquired by Citi, and then this is over a period of a decade. 2003, I looked at my calendar and I had three separate training programs, one for Salomon, one for Citi, and one for Travelers. And I called the HR person at Citi and I said, you know what, I don't feel like doing three separate ones. You're one company now. You've been one company for 5 years. Can we consolidate the program? She said, no, that would never work. I said, why? So the Citi people don't get along with the Salomon people, and the Salomon people don't get along with the Travelers people. And I said, and in a sense, it's a microcosm of what happens to these companies, because when you talk about cost savings, what are you talking about? Essentially, you're going to consolidate training programs. This might be unfair, but I'm sure that what happened in my small corner of the world was happening in lots of different places. Which means that even if there's synergy, it takes a long time for it to show up. In fact, let's see how we'd value that. What if I told you that there is synergy in this merger, $17.2 billion worth, but because these are two big companies coming together, it'll take 5 years before the synergy shows up? Let's start with the easy question first. If you have to wait 5 years, is the value of synergy going to be less than $17.2 billion or more than $17.2 billion? It's going to be less. That was the easy question. Now the question is, how do I figure out how much less? What would I have to do mechanically to bring in the five-year waiting period into my value? I'll have to discount. That's easy still. At what rate? Come on, work it through. Who gets the savings? The combined company, right? And if it's a combined company that gets the savings, I should be using the cost of capital of the combined company. This is one of those few cases where you actually talk about the blended cost of capital, is when you talk about valuing synergy pieces. So if the combined company's cost of capital is 9%, I discount $18.2 billion back. 5 years at 9%, I'll end up with like $15 billion. That becomes my value for synergy. Let's take a second example. How did I get to a third example? Okay, the first example, of course, I talked about already. Combining two companies is an illusion because you could have done it yourself. Take a third example. Let's assume that Best Buy, this is actually a bad example because Best Buy is on its last legs too, right? So let's say Best Buy, the electronics retailer, was in a healthier state of, you know, where it actually made money. I was looking at Zenith, a company with only one asset left. You know what the asset is? That they've lost a lot of money for a long period. You can say, why is that an asset? They've accumulated a lot of NOLs. That's a kind of scary place for a company to be when all you have to offer the world is, hey, we have a lot of losses. Okay? But you got to take what you can. So let's say that the only thing that Zenith brings to this picture, to this process, is a big NOL of $2 billion. Let's look at valuing that NOL if Best Buy is buying the company. Let's say the tax rate for Best Buy is 36%. If Best Buy has enough income right now to claim the entire NOL, let's assume the tax guys are going to let them do it. What's the value of this NOL? 2 billion times 36%, which would be 720 million. That's how most bankers value NOLs. They take the NOL multiplied by the tax rate. But that works only if you have the income to cover the NOL. Let's make this a little messier. Let's assume that Best Buy has only $500 million in taxable income, and that's what they can expect to make for the next 4 years. So what happens to savings? I get how much in savings in year one? 180 million in year one, 500 times 36%, 180 in year two, 180 in year three, 180 in year four. So to calculate the value, what do I have to do? Discount. That is again the easy part, at what rate? What's the risk here? That you will not get the tax benefit. The risk is that your taxable income doesn't come in at $500 million, right? Who's generating the taxable income? Best Buy is. You say, what about Zenith? Zenith is nothing. It's just a shell with a big NOL. I would discount the 180 million at the cost of equity. Why cost of equity? Because taxable income is after interest expenses, at the cost of equity of Best Buy over 4 years. What I'm trying to lay out is a process by which, because this is something you're going to face over the rest of your lives if you're in finance, because you're going to come up with a bunch of cash flows there. What discount rate should I use? My suggestion is go to the source of the risk. Think about what's causing the risk, because usually that should tell you whether you should use a cost of equity or a cost of capital, whether you should use an acquiring company or a target company or a blended number. Here I would use Best Buy's cost of equity, because the risk we're talking about is the risk in that taxable income, which is an after-interest tax income. So that's basically how I'd compute the present value. So you take the present value of 180 million every year for 4 years, let's say at the cost of equity of 10%. Let's say you come up with 450 million. Almost home, right? Now let me ask you a question. Would you pay that as a premium on the market value today? Why not? Why can't you take the question I'm asking is, why can't you just value synergy, which is what a lot of bankers do, and add it as a premium to the market price? What's the problem with doing that? What's in Zenith's market price? Who knows, right? Investors are building in expectations. What kind of expectations do you build in for a company with big NOLs? That somebody will buy the NOL, right? So in other words, the market price already incorporates what investors are building in as what they think the NOL is worth. You pay a premium on top of that, you're double counting. Market price plus is one of the most dangerous games to play, and that's why public company acquisitions, you got to be very careful, because you start with market price and you build up. Who knows what's already embedded in the market price?
Yeah. If all you're getting is 450 million in benefits, why isn't that only what you're paying?
That's all you'd pay. But that's my problem, is to do that, you got to remember that the market price doesn't even matter here. You're building from scratch. You're doing an intrinsic valuation. But in acquisitions, the market price lurks in the background, right? Because you know, to get this deal done, what do you have? Because when you come with the 450 million, what have I already told you about the deal? Walk away. It doesn't make sense for you. And you're the banker, and you go say, oh, this is awful, bad news. Let me think of a way in which I could justify it. Market price plus is where you're going to go to get deals done. Fourth example. In the late 1970s, there was a tax law rewrite. And have you ever seen how Congress rewrites tax laws? It's awful. It's like watching sausage factories working overtime. You end up with this 1,500-page document. Every tax reform act, which claims to make tax laws simpler, is 1,500 pages. Already a problem there. And people slip in things into the tax code at the last moment. And nobody says, I don't know how that happened. There must be congressional people saying, let's slip that in. Nobody will notice. Let's put in a code, and the congressional aide says, let me put my address in and say, anybody who lives in this address never has to pay taxes again. Who's going to notice it? Let it pass through. So in the late 70s, now the tax code gets rewritten. And for some accidental reason, there was this period of time where acquiring companies are actually allowed to write their assets up to the full purchase price at the time of the acquisition. It was a mistake. Everybody admitted it was a mistake, but it came into the tax code. And the minute that happened, of course, you had acquirers kind of get up and say, oh my God, I can take advantage of it. And this was actually one of the earliest leveraged transactions I know of, where a company called Congolium, it's a company that makes linoleum kitchen floors, was acquired in this, was targeted in this acquisition where the takeover was done at $400 million. But after the takeover, the acquirers were allowed to write up the value of the assets to the full $400 million. You think, who cares? Okay? Here's how it shows up. Before the acquisition, the depreciation was based on the old book value, which was much lower. After the acquisition, because I let you write up the assets to $400 million, the depreciation jumped. The increase in depreciation every year is essentially a bigger tax deduction you get, which in turn saves you taxes. If you take the present value of those tax savings, what you get as a present value of $42 million is in fact a premium you're getting because the tax code allowed you to write up depreciation. So out of the $400 million they paid, more than 10% of the value came from this one provision, a mistake in the tax code that they took advantage of. So that's why purchase price allocation becomes such a big deal, because it can affect your depreciation. By affecting your depreciation, it can affect your cash flows, and by affecting your cash flows, it affects value. So don't get distracted by that goodwill item. It's really what happens to your depreciation that can affect your value. And that's basically what you're bringing. So if I were to summarize my thoughts about synergy, I'm not saying synergy doesn't exist, but don't let it become a filler. Fill in what sense? A word used to explain away the difference between what you should have paid for something and what you actually pay. Okay. In fact, Mark Sirower, who used to teach strategy here and then went on to consulting firms, wrote, I think, one of the best books written by a strategist. And my list of strategist books that I've actually read is this long, called The Synergy Trap. If you get a chance, read it. It's about how synergy gets used as this weapon in acquisitions to stop discussion. It's a word. Okay? So go past the word, value it, because no matter how complex a synergy, your job is to make sure you're not overpaying. And your job, if you're an acquirer, is not pay the entire synergy, right? Because then you get nothing for your shareholders, is to negotiate for a portion of that synergy. So if $450 million is the present value of the NOL tax benefits, don't pay $450 million because then you've given away everything. You want to buy it for $350 million. And that's why I want you to separate control from synergy. Control, you might have no choice but to pay a big chunk of the control because the target company is going to say, well, I can fix my debt ratio myself. Why do I need you? Synergy, you are an integral part of this process, and you should demand your fair share because you're bringing something to the table and you should be taking something away. Any questions about synergy? The next acquisition that you read about, and there'll be one, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, read the entire story. First, when they start describing what they call synergies, ask yourself, are they talking about control? Are they talking about synergy? And if they talk about synergies, ask a follow-up question about how you would value that particular synergy. It's a good exercise in kind of understanding where synergy comes from. Now let's talk about pricing in the context of acquisitions. Okay. Now in pricing, what do you need? You need a multiple and you need comparables, right? Let's assume that at this stage I'm getting frustrated, or you're getting frustrated because you want this deal to go through. It's a $60 million company, you want to pay a premium. I'm not letting you use any of the easy routes, like using your cost of capital, using a debt ratio. So you come back to me with what you think is your coup de grace. You say, this is my argument. You say, you know what? Forget about all that intrinsic value stuff. It's for academics. The EBIT for this company is 20 million. And I've looked at other transactions, transaction multiples. You know what that is? Companies that have done acquisition in the past. And these companies historically have paid 5 times EBIT to do their acquisitions. You see where this is going, right? 5 times 20 million is 100 million. So that's what you should be paying. It's pricing, right? Based on comparables. Why is pricing the name of the game in acquisitions? Because you've got to get a deal done. It's like being a realtor. You can't say this, the intrinsic value of your house is 300,000, 300,000. Who cares? If you can sell it for a million, you're going to sell it for a million. So as bankers, I understand the need for pricing. But you're pricing based on a sample. That's always the case. The question is this a legitimate sample? We're going to come back to that. Let's say you push back and say, I don't know, I like DCFs, you know. I said, what if I let you use cash flows for the next 5 years and then use 5 times EBIT on the 5th year's cash flow? I'm still using a pricing and a multiple, but I'm pushing it out. And if that doesn't convince you, I hit you with what I think is my strongest argument, which is, if you do this acquisition, it's going to be accretive. What does that mean? What does accretive mean, at least in context? The earnings per share of the acquiring company will go up. Let's take each of these pieces, because I've heard all three used in acquisitions and see what the danger with each one is. Let's start with the first one. In statistics, sampling is okay. It's perfectly okay that you sample, but the one thing you're taught in statistics is you don't want your samples to be biased. So if you pick 15 chemical companies out of 100, I'm going to let you go if you pick the 15 randomly. But what have you done here? You've picked other companies that have done acquisitions and seen what they paid. See where the bias is? If you're valuing a steel company for an acquisition, you want to look at all steel companies, not at just the 3 steel companies that have been acquired, because if in acquisitions people tend to overpay, your sample is going to already incorporate that. So if you're going to use pricing in acquisitions, be honest about the pricing. Bring in other companies in the sector, not just transaction multiples. So you've been taught to use transaction multiples in any of your M&A classes, go through, rip those pages up into small pieces, throw them away. Because it's awful statistical advice. It's a very bad way to think about acquisitions. Second, on the accretive dilutive, don't even let those words drive your acquisitions. And here's why. For a deal to be accretive, all you have to do is either buy a company with a lower PE ratio than yours or use a lot of debt. Right? You can see why both work, right? If you buy a lower PE ratio, the math will alone make it accretive. If you use a lot of debt, of course, because you're not issuing shares, be accretive. If you tell me that any deal where you buy companies with lower PE ratios that you fund with a lot of debt are good deals, you're in big trouble, because that's not the essence of a good deal. So if you're ever hear the words accretive, dilutive, let it pass by. It should not be affecting your decision, because it really makes no difference. So don't be a lemming. Just because everybody else is doing it doesn't mean you've got to build it in. And don't let that accretion dilution thing kind of get in the way of thinking about a transaction, asking, is it a good transaction? So if you want to use pricing on acquisitions, do it, but do it right. Do it the way we talked about, adjusting for differences, bringing in the sector, trying to be as unbiased as you can. But here's the problem you're going to run into. Let's say after all of this, you still can't find a good reason for this acquisition. It doesn't make sense to pay more than the 60 million. So I want you to pay 90 or 100 million. You can't get that. So I hit you with my final argument. You know what? The CEO of the acquiring company really, really wants to get this deal done. See where I'm going? Which is, if this process gets pushed from the top down and if the acquiring company CEO really wants to get this deal done, it will get done, with or without you. And this is where, as a banker, it becomes easy to rationalize what you do. You say, look, I know this deal is stupid, but they're going to do it anyway. So if I don't help them on this deal, they're just going to walk down the street to Goldman Sachs and get them to help. So why should Goldman Sachs make the money? I'll make it. It's like walking behind somebody at Penn Station and he has a $100 bill, you know, hanging out of his pocket. And you reach over and you pull it out and say, look, if I didn't pull it out, somebody else would anyway. I know it's, but it's so easy to get into that rationalization, you know, when you do it. I'm sorry? There you go. I would say this is a test to see if any of you do it. So the M&A bankers, I was expecting any moment for them to come out there and take my $20 bill out. So the test didn't work, right? So that's, I think, a factor to keep in mind is that a lot of deal-making is driven by egos. Now, I might have mentioned this study before, but there's actually a study done by a couple of researchers, maybe at Columbia, that tried to explain premiums in acquisitions, why premiums were bigger in some acquisitions than in others. And what they concluded was that companies where CEOs had big egos tended to have big premiums. Interesting, right? You say, how do they measure big egos? They get psychiatrists to come in and talk. They actually used a very simple metric. It's a very clever one. This is in the old days when you couldn't do a Google search, but there used to be this old database called LexisNexis, which is where everything was collected. So what they went in and they did was they typed in the name of a CEO into LexisNexis and saw how many mentions you got. And they adopted this rule that if you got more mentions on LexisNexis, you had a bigger ego than if you had less mentions. Simplistic measure. But they found that CEOs with bigger egos, higher profiles, tended to pay much bigger premiums. In fact, this goes to something else in behavioral finance, which looks at overconfidence in people. That overconfident people tend to bring that overconfidence to everything they do. And guess what? CEOs tend to be a subset of overconfident people. Diffident people don't rise to be CEOs. So there's a selection bias here that the kinds of people who become CEOs are those kinds of kids you hated in high school. You know what I'm talking about? Those people who thought they knew everything that really didn't but got away with it. The nature of this process, those are the people who rise to the top. And there is evidence that when you get an overconfident CEO, they're going to do what overconfident people do, which is think they know more than they do acquisitions because they think they can fix things, and that kind of transmits through. So they actually take that disease with them to whatever company they go to. Yesterday, actually, in fact, I'm going to post this on Yahoo. If you've been reading, the board of directors at Yahoo is considering the final unraveling of Yahoo. They're thinking about selling the operating business at Yahoo. And I've talked about Yahoo off and on in this class. If you sell off the operating business at Yahoo, you're getting very close to the end game that I talked about, right? Remember the game I talked about where Yahoo would end up with one employee, it could be Ms. Meyer, with two displays, one of which would carry Yahoo Japan's price and the other would carry Alibaba's price, and you come in and watch both prices every day? We're getting very close, because once you sell off the operating assets, that's all Yahoo becomes. It becomes a closed-end mutual fund with two companies. And the article I'm talking about is the one that was in the New York Times where Farhad Manjoo, who's the tech writer for the market, said that what Ms. Meyer did wrong was she did not bet the farm. Which means what? That she didn't go big. There's three problems with that statement. It's a very unfortunate choice of words if you're talking about Yahoo. First is, it's not her farm. She's the CEO of, it's not like Yahoo was hers. She's the CEO, she's betting my farm and your farm for shareholders. So first, it's not her farm to bet. Second is, even if you say she has the CEO, she can do what she wants, it's almost like she was given the farmhouse and the farm, but the rest of the farm is off limits. It's like, go bet the farm. Go bet the farmhouse rather than the farm. And the third is, betting the farm, what is it? What is it? In gambling, what are you doing? You're going for a long odds bet that you hope will pay off with a big payoff. If you're a young startup and you want to bet the farm, go ahead. But if you're Yahoo, what are you betting the farm with? You're betting with my holdings in Alibaba and Yahoo Japan. You're hoping that it pays off big. Of course, if it pays off big, you become a celebrity CEO. And it doesn't pay off big. You say, it wasn't my fault. I tried my best. With overconfident CEOs, you tell them to bet the farm. They're out there doing it right away because they think they're going to win. The probabilities get skewed. That's what overconfidence does, is it takes a 30% chance and makes it look like 70% to you. So let me illustrate how this game plays out using one of the worst deals, I think, of all time. So the deal where HP bought this company called Autonomy. It's a UK-based software business services company. It's a company that they essentially bought for about $11.1 billion. At the time the deal was made, of course, the HP CEO said it was the greatest deal, that they looked at the numbers. The deal made sense. And, of course, they had to justify the deal. And the way they justified the deal was as follows. The book value of equity at Autonomy at the time of the deal was $2 billion. That wasn't a problem, it's just book value. They called in the accountants to reassess the book value, to reappraise. Maybe the book value is wrong. The accountants came back and said, you're right, it should really be $4.6 billion. The market was already at $5.9 billion, so they said the market's attaching a premium on this appraised value. And then they said, we're going to pay an extra $5.2 billion because there's synergy. So all the usual buzzwords. And normally this would have been just another acquisition. The problem was 2 years later, HP said, we screwed up. In fact, I have to put this page up because I think it cuts to the heart of how acquisitions get played out. At the time, HP bought Autonomy. It's a very unusual deal because everybody thought they paid too much, including the bankers. So the Leo Apotheker, who was the CEO of Autonomy, of HP, at the time was in front of an analyst conference. And he was asked about this deal. How come you paid $11.1 billion? And here, I'm going to repeat word for word what he said because I can't keep a straight face while I read these words. He said, we have a pretty rigorous process inside HP that we follow for all our acquisitions, which is D.C.F, base model. And he said in reference to discounting a standard valuation, and we tried to take a very conservative view. Then he kept going. He should have stopped right there. Just to make sure everyone understands, Autonomy will be on day one. Accretive, okay, that should pretty much do it. Just take it from us. We did that analysis at great length and great detail. We feel we paid a very fair price to get a great return for our shareholders. You couldn't have written it better for me. Because 2 years later, HP said, you know what, we screwed up. They blamed accounting at Autonomy for the whole problem. Now they had a problem. They screwed up because they had to write the $11.1 billion down to $2.3 billion. How do you explain away an $8.8 billion write-off? Here's what they did. They said it was all a mistake, it was all accounting problems. So at the time they did this, I decided to go out and assign blame. I said, somebody, if you have an $8.8 billion screw-up, somebody should be held responsible. So here was my attempt at consigning losses to different players. First, I said Leo Apotheker overpaid for synergy. So $4.5 billion of this premium they should never have paid. So I'll give that to Leo Apotheker and as secondary culprits, I'll put in all the deal bankers who supported the deal. Now, of course, what this often also means is Leo Apotheker should return back all his bonuses and salary from the time, which is never going to happen. And the bankers are going to disgorge their deal fees, which is also never going to happen. Yeah. The accounting impropriety, I basically factored in at about $2.5 billion. So $2.45 billion. I said, maybe the accounting did screw up, so maybe. After Meg Whitman became CEO, the company continued to deteriorate. So I said, $1.9 billion is the current CEO. And, of course, HP's auditors who let this happen. And there you are at $2.3 billion. Big mistakes have parents, people who caused the mistake. But the problem is in any big acquisition, that is often, I think, the biggest problem is you see no one held accountable for these acquisitions. Bankers don't retain their fees. CEOs don't lose their bonuses. It's almost like you make a $50 million mistake in a project, you get fired. You make a $5 billion mistake on an acquisition, you get promoted. There's no justice in this world. Which leaves me with kind of a depressing point, because if you look at what I've described, this is not a place to go to make money, right? So let's end with a positive note. Let's assume that you have to do acquisitions. You're a serial acquirer. You're a banker in acquisitions. You have to do acquisitions. Let's think about where your odds are best. Would you rather be a sole bidder on an acquisition or be in a bidding war? That was easy, sole bidder. In fact, if you're in a bidding war, would you rather be the winner or the loser? In fact, we'll back that up. So let's start. Would you rather go after public targets or private targets? Private. Why? Because public targets, what do you have to start with? Market price plus. Private targets, everything is negotiable from the ground up. Would you rather pay with cash or pay with stock? This is a tough one. And explain to me why stock. In other words, you're saying if you're overvalued. So the conditional statement is if you have overvalued stock, you're going to pay with stock. But here's the problem. The minute you tell me you're going to pay with stock, I'm the target company shareholders. What do I read into the fact that you paid with stock? You're overvalued. So what am I going to do for the premium I demand on macro. This is a game. Think of it in terms of game theory. It's not like you're the only smart one who can do things. When you make decisions, other people observe you. So we'll come back and look at what the evidence, and it's kind of mixed evidence, as you'd expect. Okay? Small targets or large targets? Small targets, you have a much better chance of winning. That mergers of equals are nightmares to make work. Cost synergies or growth synergies? Cost synergies. In fact, let's look at the evidence. Let's start with the bidding war first. It's a graph that shows you what happens to winners in bidding wars and losers in bidding wars in terms of stock prices. So you want the line to drift up. Who do you think is the winner and who do you think is the loser? So this is the day zero is the point in time in which the bidding war ends. One side was the winner and one side was the loser. Which do you think was the winner? The winner is actually here. The loser is right there. If you're going to be in a bidding war, be the loser. Because a loser, 6 months later, 1 year later, year and a half later, is better off than the winner. Why? Because how do you win an auction? You get into a room, you see something you really want, you start bidding. You win the bidding war. You should have mixed feelings. You won, so you should be happy. But why do you win? Because everybody else in that room thought you were paying too much. That's by definition how you win an auction. It's a winner's curse in an auction. When you look across acquisitions and you look at both sides, so basically this is a graph that shows you both how big the target is. So the blue is actually small targets. As the number gets bigger, you see small to big targets, cash versus stock, with small across the board. If you look at all acquisitions, small company acquisitions, you have a chance of winning. The larger the target company, the greater the chance of losing. But if you look at cash versus stock, when you're doing cash deals, you actually are better off using cash on big deals and stock on small deals. I think the reality is when you use stock on big deals, people read into your actions. When you use stock on really small deals, maybe it's just they're using stock because it's easier for them. So it's again that game theory part going. And finally, if you look at private versus public, public companies are a much worse target in acquisition than private companies. But here's an interesting feature. There is actually a group of target companies that's even better than private businesses. You know what those are? They're divisions or subsidiaries of public companies. Remember I talked about Tata Motors buying Jaguar Land Rover from Ford? Best acquisition ever for Tata Motors. You know why? Because Ford was so intent on getting rid of Jaguar that they'd have given the division away. So if you're going to do acquisitions, make them focused, make them kind of take advantage of these holes in the process. Finally, cost versus growth synergies. There's a much greater chance that you will deliver cost synergies. So basically, you look at the percentage of companies that actually deliver what they said they will do with costs, much greater than the percent of companies that deliver what they said they would do with growth. So here's the bottom line. If you're going to succeed with mergers, you have to be disciplined. And it's very difficult to stay disciplined as you grow bigger. I believe that Valiant, when it started, actually had a good process for growing through acquisitions. But as you get bigger, it gets more and more difficult to keep doing that because you need to do bigger and bigger deals to have an impact. So that's the bottom line. So if you can stay disciplined, maybe there's a shot from acquisition succeeding. So if those of you going to M&A, if I were to hope that something good comes out of this process, that you can introduce this process of discipline somewhere along the way into acquirers, but good luck with that. Okay?
Yeah.